provide nutrition and food security to Cuba, but it failed in doing so due to U.S. sanctions. U.S. sanctions are so severe that even ships that dock on ports other than Cuba are penalized. The cargoes of these ships have to be transferred to different vessels to be brought into the island, causing additional costs. A critical step that the U.S. has in its embargo of Cuba, which it continues to this day, with the hopes of choking the island, is its sanctions on oil. Now, based on a report by Commonwealth, in April, it stated the U.S. Treasury Department blacklisted 34 ships owned by Venezuela's National Oil Company for shipping crude oil to Cuba, which imposed costly penalties on two U.K.-based oil companies and then imposed additional penalties on four companies on nine more ships in the Venezuelan oil sector, alleging that they had transported oil to Cuba. Now, OFAC continued to blacklist people, companies, and ships from Italy, Colombia, Panama, and Cyprus. He claimed that they all had provided Cuba with oil. Okay, let's bring in both of our guests now to see what they think about these harsh U.S. sanctions, like what I just mentioned, oil, and many other ones that fall under the total embargo of Cuba. Vern Lyon, former CIA officer, joins us, along with Gloria Stella La Riva, Latin American expert. Okay, Gloria, first to you. The U.S. is insistent on choking Cuba with its sanctions and also stoking the flames of anti-government protests the way that the U.S. President Joe Biden did recently, not only supporting them but also imposing additional sanctions. This is while his predecessor Barack Obama rolled back some of the economic restrictions. Why do you think the U.S. and Joe Biden in this case are so harsh against Cuba?
I believe that the U.S. objective is absolutely regime change, overthrowing the revolution. And if that were to happen, which I do not believe will happen, but if the government were overthrown by U.S. force, it would mean a bloodbath. And this is why the people are resisting for over 60 years a brutal blockade whose target is the people of Cuba. The U.S. claims that they want to free the Cuban people, but they're in fact punishing the Cuban people to try to make them give up their health care that's free, their education that's free, a country that's free, in order to be able to exploit it like it used to be.
Well, Vern, do you agree with Gloria that the U.S. is after regime change in Cuba, even though she says that's not going to happen?
Well, in that regard, you know, the U.S., even when I was sent there, was thinking about a regime change. But after the October crisis, when the United States agreed not to invade Cuba anymore, like they tried in the Bay of Pigs invasion in April 1961, the agreement with the former Soviet Union was that the United States would never again invade Cuba to try a regime change. What they did attempt to do, and what part of my mission was to bring about the way that the Cuban government is established, to bring about elections, to bring about different political parties and political viewpoints, and move away from a one political party dominant political system.
Okay, we appreciate that. That's Vern Lyon, former CIA officer, and prior to that, Gloria Estela La Riva, who is a Latin American expert. All right, you know, we have shown you how Cubans, some are dissatisfied with the way things are in their country, but many, if not most, support the governments. And that is something that's very evident in the next piece that you're going to see in terms of the way that Cubans have come out supporting the government that currently is something that's in favor with most of the population there. The former Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, once said about Venezuela with a lot of eagerness, "No food, no medicine, now no power. Next, no Maduro." Well, it seems like the Biden administration is taking the same strategy when it comes to Cuba. Inhumane, yes. Interference in another nation's affairs, also yes. Not to mention a violation of a nation's sovereignty. But if the U.S. is really concerned with humans and human rights, why doesn't it lift the Cuba embargo that has been in place for over four decades? Take a look at this. The U.N. General Assembly has called on the U.S. to end the Cuban embargo now for the 29th consecutive year. 184 countries have voted in favor of a resolution to demand the end of this blockade. Only the U.S. and Israel have voted against it. Now that should tell you something. That does it for this edition of Economic Divide. I'm Kovit Hagway. It was great to have you with us. Any questions or comments, please do send them to us. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The limelight. Hundreds of Afghans employed by G4S to guard the British embassy until last year feared they will be killed by the Taliban after being abandoned by the British, while their successors who were promised help last week have since only received redundancy notices. Ahmad, not his real name, a former close protection officer and interpreter at the British Embassy in Kabul, made a desperate plea to Britain's Prime Minister. If I could get a message to Boris Johnson, I would shout at him for help. If he doesn't help us, we will be killed, he said by phone from Kabul. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalists Matthew Weaver and Amelia Gentleman. The piece is titled, Afghans who guarded British embassy fear being killed by the Taliban. Hundreds of Afghans employed by G4S to guard the British embassy in Kabul until last year feared they will be killed by the Taliban after being abandoned by the British, while their successors who were promised help last week have since only received redundancy notices. Ahmad, not his real name, a former close protection officer and interpreter at the British embassy in Kabul, made a desperate plea to Britain's Prime Minister. If I could get a message to Boris Johnson, I would shout at him for help. If he doesn't help us, we will be killed, he said by phone from Kabul. Ahmad is now in hiding with his family, one of an estimated 300 G4S employees now doing the same, and is convinced they will be killed by the Taliban if they are found because of their work with the British. The group applied for assistance and asylum under the UK government's Afghan Relocation and Assistance Policy, or ARAP. But they said they were rejected because they were not hired directly by the British government. He said, last Tuesday, the Taliban came to my father's house looking for me and my documents. I cannot eat, I cannot sleep, I can't talk to people because I'm scared. My family is in a very bad situation. My wife is crying, and we feel that we've been abandoned. Ahmad worked at the British Embassy in Kabul before G4S lost the contract in June of 2020 to the global security company Garda World. By way of proof, he shared a photograph of himself on a British Embassy delegation to Camp Arena in Herat on 15th of November 2018. Last week, The government said all 125 Garda World Security staff will be granted the right to enter the United Kingdom after their plight was highlighted by The Observer. But the staff have had no news or advice about how to leave Kabul since then. The only communication they received on Sunday, 22nd of August, was a formal termination letter from Garda World, telling them their services were no longer required. Written in Dari, the letter for dissemination to all staff working on the British Embassy contract stated, "Dear Garda World colleagues, because Afghanistan is facing an uncertain future, recent events across the country mean that Garda World doesn't have any choice but to suspend operations in Afghanistan immediately and indefinitely." The Guard's local supervisor said everyone had felt upset and hopeless when they read the letter, which was sent by the Dubai-based Regional Director for Afghanistan. "We know of lots of people working for the United Kingdom, United States, Canadian-funded projects. None of them did this or their personnel. Instead of helping us to get out of this situation while our lives are at greater risk, they are sending this termination letter to us," the Guard supervisor said. The letter stated that any further payments would depend on negotiations between the Foreign Office and Garda World. The letter also stated that negotiations were continuing over how to get staff to the airport in Kabul. The company's management was confident that UK visas will be granted to the guards, but the logistics of getting them into the airport in Kabul remains challenging. The company's remaining British staff were taken from the company compound to Kabul Airport last Friday during an evacuation operation for all Garda World expatriate staff. None of the Afghan guards were included, according to the supervisor. Most of the security guards working at the British Embassy in Kabul have now fled their homes because they no longer feel safe, he added. "We've packed small bags and we're waiting for news. We've asked to be transported to the airport. We hope they will do that, but we're running out of time. Everyone is afraid." The prospects are even bleaker for the ex-G4S staff, most of whom were employed by the company until last week when the Taliban entered Kabul. Mohammed, a 41-year-old who was a senior watchkeeper at the World Bank in Kabul until last week and had also worked as a security guard at the British Embassy in Kabul, said the group was desperate. He has asked G4S and the British government for help on behalf of the group. G4S said we should apply for asylum. They have done nothing for us, but they should help us. He added, "We have asked the British government many times about the asylum issue, but all the emails have been rejected." Mohammed has three sons and four daughters aged between 1 and 13. He said, "We are hiding at home. We cannot go outside. The Taliban are searching house by house in the capital, Kabul, now trying to find anyone who worked with foreign people. Absolutely, they will kill me if they find me." He said, if he had an email from the British government, he could get access to the airport and a chance to fly to safety.
bomb.
The developments in Afghanistan have been making headlines for the past few days, following the chaos that ensued the abrupt U.S. troops withdrawal from the country. The Taliban's meteoric rise to power and pandemonium at the Kabul airport prompted criticisms against how the U.S. pulled out its troops and also the outcome of the 20-year war on Afghanistan. Western politicians were among those expressing regret over incidents in Afghanistan, with German Chancellor Angela Merkel saying it appeared that all the troops killed in the war had died in vain. But that's not the only bitter legacy of the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan. Russia's Security Council Secretary Nikolai Petrushev has said that Washington turned a Central Asian country into a global illicit drug laboratory in the past 20 years. In an interview, the Russian security chief noted that the production of opiates in Afghanistan have increased over 40-fold during the past two decades.
Obviously, a lot of this was being produced during the time that the United States and the NATO forces were active in Afghanistan. And there was really never a concerted effort. There were attempts every now and then, you know, to do destroy fields and to you know, persuade the farmers to produce, you know, corn or wheat or something like that. But it was not very successful, and it was never really a concerted effort on the part of the authorities to do that.
The Russian official added that the war crippled Afghanistan's economy, throwing it back decades. The United States has been training Afghan government forces for the past 20 years. Out of 300,000 Afghan troops, 22,000 have been commandos that Washington says have received special training. Despite that, the Taliban managed to sweep through the nation in a matter of days and seize the capital Kabul faster than anybody had anticipated. The rapid rate at which Afghan cities fell to the militant group also stunned Pentagon officials.
They had the training, the size, the capability to defend their country. This comes down to an issue of will and leadership. And no, I did not, nor did anyone else, see a collapse of an army that size in 11 days.
According to Russia's security chief, Nikolai Petrushev, the West was never able to train the army, police, and security services of Afghanistan, as the number of attacks in Afghanistan have increased significantly after foreign forces were deployed to the country.
The Taliban, during the course of the time the United States was so-called in charge, in Afghanistan, and really they controlled only a small part of the country. They were never in control of the entire country. Much of the Taliban influence was still making itself felt in various parts, especially in the region, some of the mountainous regions that often were inaccessible to large-scale military intervention. And the fact that that was an ongoing fight in which the Taliban were pitted against the official Afghani forces, then it seems reasonable that these would increase to the extent that they still felt themselves at war with a foreign power.
Petrushev added that the reported 40,000 civilian deaths since 2001 in Afghanistan has been understated, and that the figure doesn't include tens of thousands of Afghan troops that have been killed over the years. The Russian security official concluded that the staggering number of deaths is a result of the U.S. interference in the domestic affairs of other countries.
A shocking United Nations climate report has sounded a serious warning about global warming, saying that humans are explicitly to blame for irreversible climate change. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the report as a code red for humanity and urged an end to the use of coal and fossil fuels. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, has concluded that the 1.5 degree Celsius temperature goal of the Paris Agreement would likely be breached by 2030, a decade sooner than it projected just 3 years ago. Countries should also end all new fossil fuel exploration and production and shift fossil fuel subsidies into renewable energy. The alarm bells are deafening and the evidence is irrefutable. Greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuel burning and deforestation are choking our planet and putting billions of people at immediate risk. He also added that the report makes clear that there is no time for delay and no room for excuses. The IPCC report came just 3 months before a major UN climate conference in Glasgow, Scotland, where nations will be under pressure to pledge vigorous climate action and significant financing. The UN climate report draws on more than 14,000 scientific studies and offers the most comprehensive and detailed portrait yet of how climate change is altering the natural world and what could still lie ahead.
This is like a big rock rolling downhill. You can't just say, oh my goodness, there's a big rock and stop it. It is a process that starts and keeps going, and it is not possible to stop it. We can deflect it, and we're not even doing a good job of that, but there are things we could do.
Almost every nation on Earth signed up to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. This pact aims to keep the rise in global temperatures well below 2 degrees Celsius this century and to pursue efforts to keep it under 1.5 degrees Celsius. This new report says that under all the emission scenarios considered by the scientists, both targets will be broken this century unless huge cuts in carbon take place. The authors believe that 1.5 degrees Celsius will be reached by 2040 in all scenarios. If emissions aren't slashed in the next few years, this will happen even earlier. Scientists further warn that warming of more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above the pre-industrial average could trigger runaway climate change.
One of the things that could happen that is in the fat chance list, but it could, is that all the big corporations could say, we are on a war footing now against climate change. Everyone needs to cut their consumption of everything, and we are going to cut our production because we need to do that or we will not have a planet to live on.
With catastrophic impacts, such as heat so intense that crops fail or people die just from being outdoors. According to the Carbon Majors report, only 100 companies have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1988. ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, and Chevron are identified as among the highest emitting investor-owned companies since 1988.
That we should tell the companies, you can't do this. Not only should we prosecute, we should chop them off at the ankles, tell them they can't keep using resources and they can't keep going on with what they're doing. We will not allow them to keep producing and using resources and killing the planet.
It is expected that water problems like droughts, with its accompanying wildfires and flooding, are likely to become much worse around the world as climate breakdown takes hold. The effects will be felt across the globe, from the US, where drought is an increasing problem in the West and South, to India, where the monsoon may become more variable. Sub-Saharan Africa is also likely to experience increased drought in many areas, while flooding and drought will hit China and Europe.
Lebanon seems to be on the brink of an abyss as it grapples with a prolonged double crisis. Lebanon has been plagued by a political vacuum as politicians fail to agree on a government, while a devastating economic meltdown has become an existential threat. The situation has been widely described as the worst in Lebanon's history, with some warning that time is running out fast for those who wish to save the country. Lebanon has been without a government for a year now. The last government resigned in August 2020, days after a massive chemical blast destroyed much of the port of Beirut. The financial crisis has seen the Lebanese pound sink by more than 90% and pushed more than half of the population into poverty. The Lebanese Central Bank recently scrapped a fuel subsidy due to lack of funds. Lebanon is right now suffering from a painful fuel shortage that has caused long lines at petrol stations and worsened blackouts. Last week, over two dozen people were killed when a fuel tanker exploded as people scrambled to fill gasoline in plastic containers. There have been warnings that the fuel crisis may soon force hospitals, bakeries, and other essential facilities to shut down. The grave situation has become a serious threat to the nation. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has begun acting in a bid to resolve the crisis. Hezbollah Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah has warned against any effort to block the transfer of Iranian fuel to Lebanon. Nasrallah has warned Israel and the U.S. to stay away from ships carrying the much-needed fuel for Lebanon. The Hezbollah chief says the tankers coming to Lebanon from Iran are Lebanese territory. The resistance movement has been a key player in Lebanese politics for many years and has gained popularity for its stance against Israel. The movement is very much despised by the West, especially the U.S., which is the closest ally of Israel. Western countries have imposed sanctions on Lebanon in a bid to limit Hezbollah's influence. The sanctions have played a major role in triggering the current financial meltdown. The resistance movement's ongoing effort to ease economic hardship in Lebanon will probably improve the situation to some extent. But observers believe any effective solution for the crisis needs cooperation by all Lebanese political parties. This week, Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Prime Minister-designate Najib Mikati expressed optimism that a government could soon be formed. But on Thursday, Aoun said certain parties are blocking the formation of a new cabinet to push the country into chaos. Lebanon seems to need a competent government more than anything else at this point. Any further delay in forming a new government could have devastating consequences.
The Taliban militants took over the Afghan capital, Kabul, on Sunday and declared that the war in Afghanistan is over. They entered the presidential palace after President Ashraf Ghani fled the country, saying he wanted to prevent a, quote, flood of bloodshed. The fall of the capital came weeks after the militant group ramped up its fight against the government forces across the country, sweeping through the nation and seizing its provincial capitals at a rapid pace. In February 2020, the Taliban struck a deal with the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump that would have seen U.S. troops withdraw by May 2021 in exchange for security guarantees. After taking office, Biden said he would uphold the agreement but set the deadline for a complete combat troops pullout from Afghanistan on September 11th this year. Some U.S. politicians have described the U.S. pullout as hasty, expressing concern that the developments would facilitate attacks against the interests of Washington and its allies.
My guess would be that the Taliban, having been able to take over, are not going to want to do things that would bring the U.S. and its NATO partners back in. I think a much greater likelihood is that that organizations similar to the Taliban will be given great impetus by this.
However, many observers are pointing to the colossal failure of the West in the 20-year-long war in Afghanistan. The international community has reacted to the Taliban takeover of the Afghan capital, with some politicians, including those in the West, criticizing the upshot of their 20-year presence in Afghanistan.
It is now a given that Al-Qaeda can no longer carry out attacks against the United States from Afghanistan as they did on September 11, 2001. But everything that has followed has not been as successful and has not been achieved in the way we had planned.
Merkel added that she shared the pain of the families of old troops who were killed in Afghanistan as, quote, "it seems like now, like it was all in vain." She noted that the rapid return of the Taliban to power was particularly dramatic and terrible. Leader of Merkel's party, Armin Laschet, had earlier called the Afghanistan operation the biggest debacle in NATO's history. U.S. President Joe Biden made a televised speech on Monday addressing criticisms leveled against him for withdrawing U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan.
"I stand squarely behind my decision. After 20 years, I've learned the hard way that there was never a good time to withdraw U.S. forces."
The U.S. president blamed the Taliban's takeover on Afghan political leaders who fled the country while the army surrendered to the militant group without a fight.
"And of course, the credibility of the United States is threatened, I think, by the fact that this has been such a disastrous war, and it has exposed the fact that the United States carried on wars like this with no respect whatsoever for the people of Afghanistan. I think that from Washington's point of view, the people of Afghanistan have been dispensable. And I think that more threatens the credibility in the eyes of, people who are concerned about humanity than anything else."
The fact that the Taliban managed to capture Kabul while the U.S. combat troops were still present in the country shows that all the lives lost and all the funds spent during the 20-year war were for nothing.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Western politicians and media colluded in duping their publics into believing Afghanistan was a winnable war, says Jonathan Cook, a writer, in an article published under the heading How Taliban Surge Exposed Pentagon's Lies. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. The speed with which the Taliban have re-established their hold on a country that was supposedly being reconstructed as some kind of Western-style liberal democracy is astonishing, or at least it is to those who believe that U.S. and British military commanders, Western politicians, and the mainstream media were being straight all this time. The real explanation for the Taliban's surprise success is that Western publics were being duped all along. The United States' longest war was doomed from the start. The corrupt, entirely unrepresentative members of the Kabul elite were always going to jump ship as soon as Washington stopped pumping in troops and treasure. According to Forbes magazine, as much as $2 trillion were poured into Afghanistan over the past 20 years, or $300 million a day. The truth is that Western politicians and the media intentionally colluded in a fiction, selling yet another imperial war in a far-off land as a humanitarian intervention welcomed by the local population. As Daniel Davis, a former U.S. Army lieutenant colonel and critic of the war, observed at the weekend, since early 2002, the war in Afghanistan never had a chance of succeeding. Nonetheless, many politicians and commentators are still sounding the same tired tune, castigating the Biden administration for betraying Afghanistan, as if the U.S. had any right to be there in the first place, or as if more years of U.S. meddling could turn things around. The motive for U.S. officials and corporations to conspire in the ground deception is clear. But what about the mainstream media? The self-declared fourth state and the public supposed watchdog on abuses of state power. Why were they missing in action all this time? It is not as though they did not have the information needed to expose the Pentagon's lies in Afghanistan, had they cared to. The clues were there and even reported occasionally, but the media failed to sustain attention. As far back as 2009, as the U.S. was preparing a pointless surge of troops to tackle the Taliban, Carl Elkenberry, then ambassador to Afghanistan, sent a cable to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that was leaked to the New York Times. He wrote that additional U.S. forces would only delay the day when Afghans will take over. A decade later, the Washington highlighted the Pentagon's systematic deceptions and lying. The subtitle was At War with the Truth. Bob Crowley, an Army colonel who had advised U.S. military commanders in Afghanistan, observed, "Every data point was altered to present the best picture possible." The Post concluded that the U.S. government had made every effort to deliberately mislead the public. John Sopko, the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction appointed by Congress in 2012, had long detailed the waste and corruption in Afghanistan and the dismal state of the Afghan forces. But these reports were ignored or quickly disappeared without trace, leaving the Pentagon free to peddle yet more lies and lies and lies. In the summer, as he issued yet another report, Sopko made scathing comments about claims that lessons would be learned. Don't believe what you're told by the generals or the ambassadors or people in the administration saying, "We are never going to do this again." That's exactly what we said after Vietnam. Lo and behold, we did Iraq and we did Afghanistan. We will do this again. A good part of the reason the Pentagon can keep recycling its lies is because neither Congress or the media is holding it to account. The U.S. media have performed no better. In fact, they have had their own incentives to cheerlead rather than scrutinize recent wars. Not least, they benefit from the drama of war as more viewers tune in, allowing them to hike their advertising rates. The handful of companies that run the biggest TV channels, newspapers, and websites in the U.S. are also part of a network of transnational corporations whose relentless economic growth has been sped on by the so-called war on terror and the channeling of trillions of dollars from the public purse into corporate hands. The cozy ties between the U.S. media and the military are evident too in the endless parade of former Pentagon officials and retired generals who sit in TV studios commenting as independent experts and analysts on U.S. wars. Their failures in Iraq, Libya, and Syria have not apparently dented their credibility. That rotten system was proudly on display again as the media uncritically shared the assessment of David Petraeus, the former U.S. commander in Afghanistan. Although Petraeus shares an outsized chunk of responsibility for the past 2 decades of military failure and Pentagon deception, he called for the might of the U.S. military to be restored for a final push against the Taliban. Were it still possible to hold U.S. officials to account, the Taliban surge over the past few days would have silenced Petraeus and brought Washington's huge war scam crashing down. Instead, the war industries will not even need to take a pause and regroup. They will carry on regardless, growing and prospering as though their defeat at the hands of Taliban signifies nothing at all.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why did Imam Hussein take his family to Karbala? Why didn't he refuse to fight with several thousand fighter army of Yazid, in spite of having only 72 people in his army? Why didn't he try other methods? December 13th, 2009. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him, like the day of Mubahila. It was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam. If someone comes across a ruthless sultan who mixes up halal with haram and breaks his promise to God, they deserve living with the Sultan in the hereafter. That is to say, when someone sees such a person, they should clarify the truth through their words and actions, just as Imam Hussein did, and he paid the price for it. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones and his wives and children to Karbala in order to clarify the truth.
انا مظلوم حسين انا لا تشان
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
One can clearly notice in his lifestyle all the methods that could have been used by a descendant of the Holy Prophet to preserve the great legacy of Islam, which has been passed down by the Holy Prophet and his father as well as the genuine followers. We can clearly see everything in the lifestyle of the Lord of the Martyrs, everything ranging from clarification to forewarning to promotion of Islam to provoking the conscience of prominent figures of his time during a sermon in Mina. All these things are tangible in the lifestyle of the Lord of the Martyrs. Later on, he stood up against a great deviation and laid down his life. Imam Hussein was aware of the consequences of his movement. He was an infallible Imam. Infallible Imam's extensive knowledge and insight are beyond our heads.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the camping mat, the flashlight, and these are the trekking poles. As you may have guessed, I'm packing my backpack for a hiking trip. I'm really excited because my trip is to one of the very beautiful regions of Iran, to Nahr Lake. In Ardabil province. Nahr Lake is a lake located at the borderline of two provinces of Gilan and Ardabil. This lake is situated 48 kilometers southeast of Ardabil along Khalkhal route in one of the valleys of Baghru mountain. This lake is at the altitude of 2,500 meters above the sea level. Nahr Lake consists of a smaller and a larger lake that get connected in spring, forming a single lake. The average depth of this lake reaches 5 meters. Nahr Lake is a natural freshwater lake. Enough precipitation and abundant springs have made this lake a permanent one. This region has a wide variety of terrestrial and aquatic plants. This lake has ecological, ecotourism, beekeeping, livestock, and agricultural values. The Nahr Lake is also home to some species of migratory birds. Hunting any bird in this lake is illegal. What a punishing path Nahr Lake has! Oh, this is slope ends in the lake. I can hardly breathe. I have to take a rest. Oh my God, Nahr Lake. Looks like a beautiful postcard. It's green as far as the eye could see. This lake looks like a blue gem which shines in the middle of a meadow. Let's get closer to see what's happening there. I am now beside Noor Lake. Nature travelers have camped outside around the lake. On the other side of the lake, where it seems to be calm, some people are fishing. Because of being a freshwater lake, Noor has provided a highly suitable habitat for the fish. In late summer, fishing competitions are held in this region. However, as a nature traveler, I am against the idea of any kind of hunting or fishing. Oh, look! How many horses are here? How beautiful they are! One of them is with black spots. Reminds me of Rakhsh, Rostam's horse. As you know, Rostam is one of the heroes of Iranian legends. Here you can hire a horse and go horseback riding around the lake. The mud in some parts of the Noor Lake is swampy, and that is why swimming is forbidden in this lake. Ooh, what a cold weather! I'd better wear my jacket before I catch a cold. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Round the World with Reporters.
The National and Islamic Forces in the Gaza Strip commemorated the 52nd anniversary of Al-Aqsa Mosque burning by holding a huge rally along the separating border East Gaza. Al-Aqsa Mosque was burned by an extremist Jew in 1969. Palestinian factions expressed their condemnation of Israel's long history of crimes against Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Today marks the 52nd anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque. This incident shows the true nature of this occupation. Palestinians here vow to continue their battle against this occupation across all occupied lands. We remain united in this endless battle with all possible means.
This rally comes in conjunction with the current Israeli violations in Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque, where Israeli regime is imposing the policy of eviction and displacement of Palestinians and keeping their killing and land-grabbing operations in an attempt to Jewidize Al-Quds and get rid of its people.
Palestinians have gathered here to assert the unity of all Palestinians in the face of occupation. Palestinians are here to say no to any Israeli attempts to Judaize the Palestinian lands. Palestinians won't accept any violation against Al-Quds, and the resistance will go on until liberation of all Palestine.
The resistance declared it won't allow Israel to violate Palestinian sanctities and keep the blockade imposed on the Gaza Strip, as they agreed to activate the popular resistance and the return of clashes by the separation fence, stressing they won't remain silent over the Israeli crimes.
Palestinians have proved that they will keep their resistance in the face of all Israeli projects that aim to demolish the Palestinian identity. Al-Quds is the symbol of our history. Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque are our